Thanks for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Yesterday, Iran completed a series of missile tests, and last week, the world learned of a clandestine nuclear site inside Iran, sounding new alarms about Iran's nuclear weapons ambitions. Joining me to talk about these developments and hopes for the talk scheduled Thursday, David Albright, former UN nuclear weapons inspector, president of the Institute for Science and International Security. Karim Sajjadpour of the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Ruel Garecht of the Foundation for Defense of Democracies. And from a studio at Harvard, Nicholas Burns, professor of the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard University. We do invite your calls, questions, 800-433-8850. Send your email to drshow@wamu.org. Good morning to all of you.
Good morning.
Morning.
Good morning.
This morning's New York Times is reporting that Iran has said today it would soon offer a timetable for international inspectors to visit a hitherto secret nuclear enrichment facility, but was not prepared to renounce its nuclear program or debate its rights to operate the previously undeclared plant. I'd be interested in each of your reactions, starting with you, David Albright.
Well, one would hope that Iran would quickly allow the inspectors to investigate this plant. It's unclear when they're going to make this invitation. I don't believe the IA certainly not announced it. And I checked with the IA this morning if the public affairs at least had learned about it, and they had not. One hopes also that if Iran does allow the inspection, that it allows a real inspection, not just a visit, and that they allow the inspectors access to the people who are in charge of building the plant. They see the design information of what's going to be in the plant, and they learn when did Iran decide to build this plant. That's a key issue in deciding whether there's been a violation of Iran's safeguards agreement.
Karim Sajjadpour.
Well, Diane, I think what's interesting is that for the Obama administration, it's taken the U.S. government 30 years to prepare itself to recognize the legitimacy of an Iranian government, only to find that legitimacy has been squandered in a very public way. I'm talking about the legitimacy of the Iranian government. So I think ahead of these talks, Iran hasn't shown any indication that it's prepared to make any meaningful compromises that would meet the United States halfway or even a third of the way on these talks. And I think at the same time, they're going to show a little bit of leg in this meeting in order for there to be a second meeting. And I think this is a way of trying to recoup this legitimacy they've lost at home to show to their own population that, you know, look at great powers are talking to us. We are legitimate.
Ruel.
Well, I mean, I think if you go back and look at from 2002 when the site at Natanz was revealed, the Iranian regime has been engaged in a long process of cheat, denial, negotiations. And throughout that period of time, their nuclear program has advanced. I think the only question for the Obama administration is, will this new revelation in any way help them convince the Russians and the Germans to engage in massive sanctions against Tehran? If it doesn't, then I suspect the Iranians will win again.
Nick Burns.
Well, Diane, I agree very much with David Albright. There's a need for immediate and complete inspections. I will say that I think President Obama is right to go ahead with these talks that begin on Thursday. I think engagement, his general strategy, has been the correct one. But he now needs to ratchet up the pressure on the Iranians. And the way to do that is to demand these inspections and, as Ruel said, get quickly to the issue of sanctions and test whether China and Russia, who played a very cynical game over the last few years, are now ready to join us in the only solution short of the use of force or containment, and that's a sanctions regime.
How well have sanctions worked in the past, Nick Burns?
Well, I know something about this because I negotiated the three UN Security Council sanctions resolutions for the U.S. They were well-intentioned. I'm still convinced it was the right thing for the U.S. to have done, but they weren't implemented across the board by countries that matter. Russia, for instance, is the leading arms exporter to Iran, and despite our suggestions that they stop those arms exports, they've continued. As the Europeans began to pull back from trade with Iran beginning in 2005 and 6, the Chinese rushed in to fill that void, and China has become a leading trade partner. So I think those two countries, Russia and China, with some of the Arab countries, Japan and South Korea, they're the trading partners. They're the ones that would have to join the United States and Europe if these sanctions are to be effective.
Raul Garecht, what can you tell us about this test that Iran conducted yesterday?
Well, I mean, it's very difficult to tell. All you know for sure is that they're continuing with their missile program. And whether we have correctly assessed that missile program is a different issue. Whether the Obama administration's decision to essentially scrap the missile defense system in Poland and the Czech Republic was the wise choice, we'll have to wait and see.
Do you see a connection between the two?
Well, I think the primary reason the Iranians did it is to flex muscle, is to intimidate the Western countries to let the Israelis know that they are capable of striking, that they are preparing themselves, I think, for a very difficult future.
Karim, what the Iranians have said is that the missile tests were part of an annual military drill known as Sacred Defense Week. What do you make of that?
Well, I don't buy that the timing was coincidental, Diane. This has long been the modus operandi of the Iranian regime, that when you feel under pressure, when you feel under siege, be defiant, never compromise, because that's going to project weakness and invite even more pressure. So I think this has long been the worldview of the supreme leader, Ayatollah Khamenei. Just one word on sanctions, which I think Nick Burns put it very well. But I would also add that this is a regime which has never had the economic well-being of the Iranian people as its first, second, or third-tier priority. So they're willing to endure enormous economic hardship for reasons of ideological and political expediency. So when you ask whether or not sanctions work, they work in the sense that they'll inflict pain on the Iranian
people
and also on the Iranian regime. It's going to be hard. But will they work in changing the behavior, the nuclear behavior of the Iranian government? I'm skeptical.
What do we know about the targets that these missiles could actually reach, David Albright?
Well, I think with the missiles tested yesterday, they're really missiles for the region, including Israel. The range of some of the two longer range missiles theoretically could reach southern Europe, but I think the real targets are local and including Israel. One of the big questions, though, is Iran working to put a nuclear warhead on those missiles? And it's interesting, and this is debate's been simmering for over 6-7 months. There are real differences between various intelligence agencies in Europe and the United States over whether Iran's restarted its work to make a warhead for particularly the Shahid 3. And, for example, the German government believes, or its Federal Intelligence Service, known as the BND, believes that the program was active as of 2007 and was aimed at building a warhead for the ballistic missile. And findings within the International Atomic Energy Agency mirror that Iran is certainly has, in the past at least, worked on trying to create such a warhead.
Ruel.
Yeah. I was going to add to that. I mean, the only way that you know for certain that the Iranians do not have an active warhead program means you have an active human or technical source inside of the Iranian nuclear program. If you look at the New York Times report, I'm a bit confused because the Americans are unquestionably sharing all the intelligence they have with the British, the French, the Germans, and the Israelis. You would be able to tell quite quickly if looking at that information whether, in fact, you have an active live source. The Germans, the French, the Israelis, They're very skeptical about the American conclusion that we saw in the 2007 National Intelligence Estimate saying that the Iranians stopped their warhead designs in 2003.
Nick Burns, how did this disclosure become public? How did we find out about this second site?
Well, I don't know all the details. All I know is that the Iranians sent a letter to the International Atomic Energy Agency about a week ago, and of course, that gave the Obama administration and the French and the British the opportunity to publicly condemn what the Iranians had done, and quite rightly so. I tell you, Diane, I had a lot of conversations over 3 years when I was still in the government about the Iranians. I never met a single diplomat of any country, including Russia and China, who doubted that Iran is trying to achieve a nuclear weapons capability. So I think that's a given. There's no real international argument over that. The argument is, how do you stop them? And I do think that President Obama's engagement strategy has been smart because it's enabled us to reclaim some of the moral high ground. It's put Iran on the defensive, and it now positions President Obama to be the leader of a coalition against Iran. We can't resolve this problem alone, and I think adding as many partners as we can is the right strategy for the U.S.
Nick Burns, he's former Undersecretary of State for Political Affairs at the U.S. Department of State. Ruel Gerecht is former Middle East Specialist for the CIA. Karim Sajjadpour is at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. David Albright, former UN Nuclear Weapons Inspector, President of the Institute for Science and International Security. We'll take a short break. When we come back, we'll talk further and take your calls. Welcome back. We're joined now by Elliot Cohen. He's professor of strategic studies at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies. Good morning to you, sir. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning, Diane.
You wrote in the Wall Street Journal yesterday that there were only two choices, a strike from the Americans or Israelis, or living in a world with Iranian nuclear weapons. Which do you think is riskier?
I think there are risks that are associated with both. Just to be clear for your audience, what I argued in the article is that, unfortunately, I have no confidence that either diplomacy or sanctions, or diplomacy backed by sanctions, will get the Iranians to move away from their drive to have a nuclear program, which is really very deep-seated, as your other guests, including my former colleague Nick Burns, have pointed out. So that's the choice that we have. And both are very risky. Both are, you know, war is war. It could spread in a variety of ways, both in the Persian Gulf and in the Middle East. I think we also have to be very clear about what it means if the Iranians have nuclear weapons, and there are two consequences in particular that we have to think about. First, it's very clear that it will trigger, and in some ways has already triggered, a nuclear arms race in the region. If the Iranians have nuclear weapons, in very short order, we're going to see the Saudis, the Egyptians, perhaps the Turks, and others acquiring nuclear weapons as well. And secondly, we have an extremely dangerous regime, which to this very day, is trying to kill Americans in places like Iraq and Afghanistan, that is repressive and brutal internally, and is making all kinds of mischief in various places, which will feel emboldened by the possession of nuclear weapons, which will be it will see as a shield and also as a certain kind of triumph. So either way, the Obama administration is going to face a very, very difficult choice.
Elliot Cohen, he is professor of strategic studies at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies. Beneath this entire discussion, Professor Cohen, is the threat of an Israeli strike on Iran. Do you believe that that is a possibility, and what would be the consequences?
Well, it's certainly a possibility. I think we sometimes use the phrase existential threat without pondering what it means. Israel is a country for which the idea that people would actually like to exterminate it is unfortunately completely real. And the statements of both President Ahmadinejad and the Supreme Leader Khamenei just reinforce that sense. And so the Israelis have every reason to think that their existence may very well be at stake if the Iranians have nuclear weapons. And you can say, well, you know, plenty of countries have existed in conditions of nuclear deterrence. I think for a people that has experienced a real effort to physically annihilate every single one of them, that's not going to carry much weight. What could they achieve? The truth is, we don't really know. The Israelis would operate differently than the United States would. They'll take different risks. They'll probably have different concepts of operation. But that said, it's very unlikely that the Israelis could really do long-term damage to the Iranian nuclear program. It's dispersed. It's much better protected than, say, the Iraqi Osirak reactor was, which they destroyed in 1981. But that said, we have to bear in mind one other thing. When the Israelis attacked the Osirak reactor, they did not think they were going to be setting the Iraqi program back by more than 6 months, a year, maybe two. And they were still willing to take what was then a tremendous risk, including the risk of losing the pilots that conducted that that strike. And I think if that was their calculation then, it may very well be their calculation now.
Kareem.
I think Elliot Cohen makes some excellent points. What I would add, Diane, is that, as Elliot, I think, mentioned as well, the underlying problem we have with Iran has to do with the character of the regime more than its nuclear ambitions. What that means is that as long as these hardliners are in power, Ayatollah Khamenei remains supreme leader, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad remains president, realistically, we're never going to be able to sign a piece of paper with Iran which allays our suspicions and Israel's suspicions that Iran has abandoned its weapons ambitions. So I think we need to think about policies which somehow facilitate the transformation of this regime. My concern is that a military strike on Iran would actually be the best bet for these hardliners to heal these internal political rifts and quell the population. So I agree absolutely in terms of the analysis. My only concern is that that's exactly what the hardliners would want us to do, which is to bomb them.
If I could just interject, I agree with that. I think, and in any case, I think it's highly unlikely that the Obama administration would attack the would be willing to launch an attack which could have all kinds of repercussions, including broader conflicts in the Persian Gulf and in the Middle East. The issue is very much the Iranian regime, and I think it is very much in the American interest to step aside from the idea that we've had that we can really live in the long term with this regime. I really don't think we can.
David Albright.
Yeah, I think there's other alternatives besides, in a sense, if I can rephrase, capitulation or military strikes. I think that the United States has dealt with hostile nuclear powers in the past.
North Korea.
It still does. Soviet Union. And I think that if Iran is not willing to change its behavior in the short run, I don't think we should give up that they will not do it in the long run. And we can look to examples like Libya, South Africa, where sanctions played an important part, along with a containment strategy in case of Libya, and engagement with South Africa to get them to abandon their nuclear weapons program. So I think we have to think more long term. I also think Obama's recent decision to refocus ballistic missile defense on the short and medium range missiles is part of what I would envision is going to be a growing containment strategy that has a military component. It doesn't mean you attack Iran. I think that was the pointlessness of that was clarified by Gates, Secretary of Defense Gates, over the weekend. I mean, you can buy a year to 3 years by a strike, and you may not even – and what is a year worth in this game of nuclear weapons? It's and I'd also add that Israel thought it was buying more time than 6 months to a year. I can guarantee that. I lived in Israel when the Osirik bombing occurred, and as part of my inspection work during the 90s, I had a particular interest in all the underlying information on that strike and had access to Iraqi statements about it at the same time. They thought they were buying years.
Ruel.
I'm highly skeptical that the Israelis will be convinced by any containment argument. I mean, the Europeans, and particularly the Germans and the Italians, are barely on board with a sanctions strategy as it is. I think, given their past, what is most likely is if the Iranians do go nuclear, you'll see the Germans, the Italians, and the Russians and others say, all right, let's go back to normal engagements, the way to go. Let's have more trade, not less. I think it will be extremely difficult for the Americans to maintain a containment strategy. And I would also say the Iranians have a real risk if the Israelis do strike. If the Israelis strike and the Iranians are not really able to bring hell down upon Israel, then I think the investments that they have made, not only rhetorical, but particularly in the Hezbollah and the radical Sunni groups, who they would need to strike to show their power, to show, in fact, there is a united Islamic front against Israel. If that doesn't materialize, the Iranians are in a lot of trouble. And I think it's also important to remember that that much of the Iranian religious left, people like Rafsanjani's not really there, but he's really the father of the nuclear weapon. He argued strenuously that the current regime was endangering the nuclear program by being too aggressive. That, in fact, if the Israelis strike, they're more or less justifying the critique of those who have criticized the regime for its aggressive, inflammatory behavior.
Nick Burns.
Diane, I don't favor the use of military force right now by Israel or the United States for a few reasons. First of all, I'm not aware of any convincing scenario where the use of military force would work. Secondly, you'd have to assume that Iran, which is a powerful nation, is going to respond.
Why would not military action work?
You can't bomb human knowledge. What we're trying to stop is a scientific process here. It's the process of uranium enrichment. When Iranian scientists have mastered that, then the game is up, that particular aspect of the game. Elliot, if you just let me just continue the thought. I don't think it would work. You have to calculate that Iran would most probably strike back against us in Iraq, perhaps through Hezbollah and Hamas. So you have to weigh the risks, and I think the risk outweigh the possible gains. I'd also say, to Elliot's question, and he's a good friend of mine, that I don't think it's just if sanctions and negotiations fail, we'd be left with a military strike or living with it. As David says, there is the possibility of containment. How would that work? Build up defenses in the Gulf with the Gulf states. Build up Israel's defenses. Security assurances to the Gulf states and Israel. And we could make clear to the Iranians that any use of nuclear weapons or threat of the use of nuclear weapons would have the most severe repercussions. We contain the Soviet Union and Mao's China. Iran is not 10 feet tall, and we ought to see containment as a worthy option for a future American president alongside the use of force.
Elliot Cohen.
First thing I would say is containment is a nice way of saying living with Iranian nuclear weapons, and I think we ought to be clear about that. Secondly, I think the model of our relationship with the Soviet Union is really something very different from having from the consequences of Iran's behavior in the Middle East. The issue is not so much that Iran's going to attack us directly. This is not a bipolar relationship between the United States and Iran. The issue is Iran in the Middle East. And I would say a couple of things. First is, while it's perfectly reasonable for a bunch of Americans sitting in Boston and Washington and elsewhere to say, tell the Israelis, you know, this isn't going to do any good, I remind everybody the issue for them is existential. And when things are existential, you take risks. And to what David Albright said, I've spoken to some of the Israelis who both designed and conducted that raid, and they were willing to do it even if they thought the outcome would be a lot less than it ended up being. Second thing is, Iran is very unlike South Africa, which wasn't really threatening anybody. In fact, that regime was on the point of collapsing when they gave up their nuclear weapons. And it's not like Libya, which frankly was kind of a negligible power, which was not able, it was able to make some mischief in terms of things like the Pan Am bombing or some support for the IRA. But it's nothing like the scale of what the Iranians do and aspire to do in the broader Middle East. And I think it's very important to fall back on the nature of the regime. Last thing I would say is it's all very well to talk about guarantees of American support and defenses and so on. You know, just a few days ago, on the anniversary of the Russian invasion of Poland, we woke up the Polish foreign minister in the middle of the night to tell him that that agreement, which we had signed with them for missile defense, was going to be changed. Well, if you're an American ally, you're going to be watching this. And if you're thinking, which would I rather rely on, some American missiles which may or may not show up, which the Americans might yank the way they did on the Poles, or my own nuclear weapons, I know which way I'd go.
At 27 before the hour, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Elliot Cohen, in the last paragraph of your piece yesterday in the Wall Street Journal, you say it is therefore in the American interest to break with past policy and actively seek the overthrow of the Islamic Republic, not by invasion, but through every instrument of U.S. power. What exactly do you mean?
Well, I think you neglected to mention the phrase that followed that, soft more than hard.
Right.
Look, at the end of the day, I am not recommending to this administration the conduct of military strikes, in part because I don't think they could follow through with it. But I very much agree with Karim and with some of the others there. I think the problem is fundamentally the regime. There are a variety of things that you can do. I mean, we did all sorts of things, for example, with East Europeans in the 1980s that made it difficult for the communists to hang on there. We should do those sorts of things. Many of them are really completely innocuous kinds of things that have to do with, you know, broadcasting and just making sure that people can communicate with one another. Part of it is political. I was very disappointed by the response of the Obama administration when we first began to have these large protests in Iran, which we sort of dismissed and only gradually gave some lukewarm support to. But I think, and then there are other things which one simply can't discuss. But I think we need to be very clear. The problem is the Iranian regime. The problem is the totality of Iranian behavior, of which nuclear weapons and the quest for nuclear weapons and the quest for means of delivering nuclear weapons, because these missiles don't make any sense unless they have nuclear warheads on them, is a large part of the problem, but it's only part of the problem.
All right. We're going to open the phones now, 800-433-8850. First to Frederick, Maryland. Good morning, Nancy. You're on the air.
Well, good morning, Diane. Thank you so much for taking my call.
Surely.
I come from a pro-peace perspective, and my concern is that we're building more division and more fear. I'm concerned that that we don't see the Iranian people's perspective at all. You know, they have reasons to be afraid of America, too, because we've got a huge storehouse of nuclear weapons, and we have used them. They have reasons to be afraid of Israel. They have historical reasons. Everyone is after their oil, and we have overthrown their government. So, to me, if we, in the past, you know, most Mossadegh, the CIA did.
Yes.
So it seems to me that that it's very courageous of them to tell us where their, or tell somebody where their nuclear materials are. We have to give them the benefit of the doubt.
All right. Thanks for calling. Karim.
I agree with the caller's point about, refraining from military action. But when she says we should see it from the vantage point of the Iranian people, I agree with that. And I think what the Iranian people are focused on these days is how they've been brutalized the last few months by their odious regime. I mean, this is a population which, people have been sent to prison, have been raped, been tortured, and their focus is far more these days on the brutality of their regime rather than U.S. double standards. I would just add that, you know, when we embark on these talks with the Iranians, I think it's important as a government that we also do bring up the question of human rights. And it's not because by talking about this, Ayatollah Khamenei and Mahmoud Ahmadinejad are going to improve their human rights record, but it's to show to the Iranian people that the U.S. government is concerned about your well-being. It's not only about nukes. We're not.
Are they getting that message?
I don't think they are getting that message. I receive dozens of emails every day from Tehran saying that, you know, why is the U.S. government legitimizing this regime? I agree very much with Nick Burns that we don't have other options. We have to talk to the Iranians.
But will China and Russia sign on there?
I think, you know, those who live in glass houses aren't going to throw stones. So countries like China and Russia, which are not democratic themselves, are never going to bring up Iran's human rights record. But I think as the United States, we always need to, you know, take this moral high ground and have very clear moral standards.
Karim Sajjadpour, the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. We'll take a short break now. And when we come back, your email, your tweets and messages from Facebook. Stay with us.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. By the German Embassy, presenting Germany Info, a web publication with daily news from Germany, business and investment information, and suggestions for travel to Europe on the web at germany.info. And by Global Nutritional Research, maker of Clotamin, a multivitamin designed for people on blood thinners, at clotamin.com. This is NPR.
A family torn apart, four siblings tell their versions of becoming orphans, being separated, and finally reuniting as adults. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. Welcome back. As we talk about Iran's possession of weapons that could, in fact, be very, very destructive, not only to the region, but elsewhere. Let's go right back to the phones. Louisville, Texas. Good morning, Philip. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm kind of concerned if, is this, the Iran situation with the U.S. any way similar to how they have weapons that are, can be pretty much affected to us in a bad way, how Russia had with the nuclear weapons back then?
Nick Burns.
Oh, I would say that Iran is much less of a threat to the United States today than the Soviet Union was for the five decades of the Cold War. There's really no comparison. And it gets back to this issue that we were discussing before the break. I fundamentally disagree, Diane, with my friend Elliot, that regime change is an option for us. It hasn't worked in the past. The more the U.S. tries to intervene, the less influential we are, which is one of the reasons why I think that President Obama has handled the situation skillfully. He now has a credibility that previous American presidents have not had internationally. If we try to resolve this unilaterally, I think we'll fail. We may not be able to have negotiations and sanctions succeed, but we'll have a better chance if other countries are with us.
Ruel.
So I think a patient policy is the order of the day.
Ruel.
Well, I mean, I think it always takes two to tango. And June 12th really did change the chessboard in Iran. And if we discover that Iranians really want to have more contact with the United States, if we discover that Iranians really would respond well to having much more American television, Persian broadcasting into Iran, more radio, then I think it behooves us to give them what they want to listen to. And we're not talking about a covert program where we try to repeat 1953. That's simply not going to happen. But to say that the Iranians don't deserve the type of support that we gave to the Eastern Europeans, I don't operationally or ethically or strategically understand that.
David?
Yeah, I'm all for that. I mean, it makes sense, but I don't think it'll be decisive in this. I mean, history does not show that U.S. intervention on with Radio Free Europe or Voice of America or whatever is going to change a regime's behavior. I mean, it's important. I think it should be done more in the context of Iran. They certainly need information, and the Iranian regime is tightening its controls over the press. And so that makes sense, but I don't think that's going to solve this problem. And I think the nuclear is, in a sense, the vanguard of all the issues we have with Iran, because it's the most threatening, and it's the most threatening to a very close ally, namely Israel. And
Elliot so, Cohen.
Diane, a couple of things. First, I'm afraid my friend Nick Burns may have mischaracterized what I said both here and in the article. I didn't talk about doing anything unilaterally. I'm very much in favor of doing things with allies. And it's also, I think it should be clear, I'm not saying that we can overthrow the regime. That regime will go under because of what the Iranian people want. My view is we should stand with the Iranian people who've been extremely courageous in risking their lives for this regime. And, you know, we didn't bring communism down on our own. That was done largely by movements like Solidarity, but we helped Solidarity. And I think in a similar way, we should help people who stand for freedom and a more decent form of government there. The other thing I think it's important to point out, is this as directly dangerous to us as the Soviet Union was potentially? No. But bear in mind two things. One is Iran really has been waging war against the United States. There are hundreds, if not thousands, of Americans who've been killed by Iranian technology, Iranian tactics, even Iranian operatives in some cases, in places like Iraq, in Afghanistan, through the attack on our barracks in Saudi Arabia. Looks likely, possibly as well, the barracks in Beirut. I mean, they really have actually killed quite a few Americans.
All right.
And they continue to do that. And the second thing is we should not make light of what a world in which the Middle East gets nuclearized, because people will not put their trust in American missiles and American missile defenses, what a nuclearized Middle East might look like. And I think the danger, unfortunately, and it may be one that we simply have to accept, is we could move into a world in which there will be nuclear exchanges, not necessarily where we're the ones who are flinging nuclear weapons around, but people in that part of the world are. And that is a serious and dreadful prospect.
All right. I have an email here from Ned, who says, I smell a rat or two here. One, those who lied us into the Iraq war are at it again. Two, the Iranians are not dummies. They can and did learn from Saddam Hussein and from North Korea. That is, A, make it look like they might be going for nuke bombs on the cheap, get lots from eventual negotiations. B, pretend you're more powerful than you are to gain prestige and bargaining power. Three, the secret site was not really secret. Google Earth enabled people to watch the last war between Israel and Gaza, Israel and Lebanon. Who benefits financially from each solution? all this has been said about North Korea. Have they dropped the bomb on South Korea? This extremely dangerous regime has not attacked anyone directly, period, since the Shah was deposed. Nick Burns.
I think the regime is malevolent. I agree with Elliot and Ruel on this. They have supported all the Middle East terrorist groups. They've supported the Shia militant groups against our soldiers in Iraq. I don't agree with this person, with Ned, who said in those thoughts. But I would say this, Diane. All of us on this panel, I think, could agree that we want to stand with the Iranian people. We want people-to-people and cultural contacts. That's not the issue. The issue is, do we use force and start a third war potentially in the greater Middle East, or do we try a more patient and, I think, more sensible combined strategy of negotiations, inspections, sanctions? I'm for where President Obama wants to take us, and I'm very skeptical that the use of force would serve American interests, certainly not the use of Israeli military force or our own.
And here's another email who says there are actually three choices for Iran. Number one, a military strike. Number two, live in a world with Iranian nukes. Three, a comprehensive Middle East nuclear treaty. How much of an opportunity is there for that?
Yeah, I think the second option I would amend. We don't have to live with Iranian nuclear nukes. I mean, we can continue to oppose them and construct a strategy to continue to try to persuade Iran and with economic, political, and even military pressure to give up those nuclear weapons. And again, we've seen that happen in regimes and in South Africa. At one point, there were 50,000 Cuban troops in Angola fighting South African forces. There were deep concerns in South Africa about Soviet tactical nuclear weapons on its ships. So we've gone through some very hairy situations. And in the end, the persistent, patient pressure can pay off. And in the end, certainly the regime is going to have to transform in Iran to give up its nuclear weapons ambitions. But I think we can continue to fight for that, even as Iran makes progress towards nuclear weapons. And I think that pressure will also keep Iran from moving quickly toward nuclear weapons.
Kareem.
I agree with David. I think ultimately this Iranian regime is odious, but it's not suicidal. In fact, what we saw from the last 3 months is it ruthlessly wants to stay in power. It's not going to do anything which could potentially invite massive reprisals. And I think ultimately the fate of this Iranian regime is going to be similar to the fate of the Soviet Union in the sense that it will crumble under the weight of its own contradictions and its own economic malaise that could take place in 1 year, it could take place in 5-7 years. But I think ultimately that's our answer. We're going to have to contain it until there is some type of broad transformation of the character of this regime.
Elliot Cohen, containment.
Well, I mean, at the end of the day, as I've said now several times, I don't advocate our use of force under the Obama administration, and I'd rather the Israelis don't do it either, although we should be under no illusions about our ability to prevent them from doing that. I think we will probably walk into something like containment, but let's be aware of just how dangerous that is potentially. And let's also remember that part of what containment usually contains is some fairly blood-curdling threats, which is what the Cold War was all about. I disagree very much with David Albright. This is a much more dangerous situation than South Africa, which was collapsing, I think it's important to remember, and for which the nuclear weapons serve no purpose. The regime views the nuclear effort as one of its central achievements. It's not going to just give it up easily. And I think the reason why I wrote my article is because I think there's a tremendous temptation to fool oneself in all this, to think that maybe somehow this time you can persuade the Iranians to negotiate in good faith, that somehow this time, you know, the sanctions will work. Somebody once defined insanity as what happens when you keep on doing the same thing and expect different results. We've been doing those things. They haven't worked. They're not going to work. We're going to live with Iranian nuclear weapons, but it's going to be pretty hairy, and what we need to do is accelerate the time when, as Kareem said, the Iranian regime will fall of its own weight to the Iranian people. The point is we ought to make sure that the Iranian people get all the help that we can give them to speed that day up.
Dave.
Yeah, I think it's incorrect to say that the South African regime was falling apart all the time. In the 70s and 80s, it was quite strong. What led it to fall apart was international pressure on the nuclear front. There was a Security Council resolution 77, largely motivated by concerns about South African nuclear weapons, posed a military embargo on South Africa. Sanctioned imposed an economic tax on South Africa that wore down that regime. So at the end, yes, it was failing, but it failed largely because of two things, international pressure and internal pressure. And to say that somehow it's not a good example misses the point. It was a very successful effort launched by many nations and people to bring down and change the apartheid regime that was dangerous because it had nuclear weapons.
All right, to Leonard in Princeton, New Jersey. Good morning. You're on the air.
Hi, Diane. Welcome back.
Thank you.
My question is based on the premise that that the Iranians don't have the technical design capability and manufacturing capability for the equipment to go into these facilities. And I remember some years back, German corporations were selling, I believe, to Iraq similar equipment and shipping it to other countries. My question really is, if Iran can't make it themselves, where are they buying this equipment?
Ruel.
Well, they the Iranians are buying equipment for all over the place, and they have been for almost 30 years. Two,
they can get it wherever they want.
Well, so far they've been reasonably successful at evading efforts to stop their importation.
Even though sanctions are already in place.
Yes, even though sanctions are already in place. So, I mean, I think people have become much more attentive, at least in Europe, where the Iranians were getting a lot of dual-use items, to the Iranian threat. But even there, I'm deeply suspicious that German and Italian products aren't getting into Iran, and they're using them in the nuclear weapons program.
At 7 minutes before the hour, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Nick Burns, on that point, if under sanctions already in existence, the Iranians are getting what they need to continue development of this program, what makes you believe that the imposition of further sanctions is going to make a difference?
The current sanctions in place, there were three UN Security Council resolution sanctions passed over 2 years between 06 and 08. They're just weak. They're not sufficiently strong. It's the best we could do, but Russia and China single-handedly prevented us from having tougher sanctions. So I think we need to get to a point where if these negotiations fail, and I expect they will fail in the next month or two, to a much tougher sanctions regime. But, Diane, I guess I'd say, you know, both President Bush and President Obama have faced a series of very difficult choices here. There are no good or easy choices. And I think we'd be fooling ourselves to think that somehow turning now to military confrontation or regime change is the way forward. I think the better, smarter strategy is to ratchet up the pressure, try tough sanctions. If they fail, build that military containment of Iran. We were successful in doing that in the past with the Soviets and the Chinese.
I think Nick Burns makes some great points, and I would add three in terms of how the dynamic has changed. Oil prices have contracted significantly. So when oil is at $120 a barrel, it's much easier for Iran to pursue these non-compromising policies. It's going to be much more difficult for the Ahmadinejad government. This time around, there's tremendous internal pressure as well, internal demand. And lastly, I would say that the approach of the Obama administration has been smart in the sense that it's the focus these days is not on the U.S. not engaging as it was during the Bush administration. The focus is on Iran's intransigence. And I think from the vantage point of the Iranian people, from the vantage point of our allies, including the Russians, it's clear to everyone that Iran is the unwilling partner in this equation, not the United States.
Elliot Cohen, is the U.S. policy a good one right now?
No, I don't really think so. And the main reason why I don't think so is because it's holding out a false hope that you can negotiate a deal with a regime which has indicated it's not going to deal with you. And it's holding out hopes for sanctions, which the Russians and Chinese have repeatedly told us they're not going to give us. And I think what we're getting is a lot of soothing words. We are probably going to be headed into a world with Iranian nuclear weapons. And under those circumstances, I agree, you know, you do everything you can to contain, to deter, and all that. But I think it's very important for them to be clear to the American people what that entails. And I also think it's important to remember, you know, in the conduct of foreign policy, everything is connected to everything else. So when we do what we just did to the Poles, you know, our friends in the Persian Gulf see that, and they will draw their conclusions. The conclusions are we're not terribly reliable. We're capable of pulling the rug out from under them in the same way that we just pulled the rug out from the under the current Polish government. So are we headed down this course? Probably. There's nothing that I or anybody else can say to change it, and I'm not sure that I would. But I think it's the, you know, it's the obligation of leadership to be very, very clear to your own public just how dangerous a situation you find yourself in.
Elliot Cohen, David Albright, Karim Sajjadpour, Ruel Gerecht, and Nicholas Burns. Thank you all for a very lively discussion. And thanks for listening, all. Have a great day. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, and Denise Couture. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR, National Public Radio.